All right. Tonight we'll be covering Lesson 17, Rebuilding the Walls. We'll be covering Nehemiah Chapter 1 through Chapter 7. Before we get started with the introduction, I have to confess to you that this is one of my most favorite sections of the Old Testament. The reason why it's so special is because I believe it's so directly applicable to us. This section that we'll be covering, especially tonight, is rich with application for our present time. I think in many ways it is parallel to our time today. If you think about the Jews, they have come out of captivity, and they're no longer struggling with idolatry. Instead, they're struggling with the problems of complacency and materialism, losing focus, being more focused on this material world. We can think back to the lesson of Haggai, how the people were not building the temple at that time. Instead, they were building their own houses. In fact, they were building paneled houses. So they had lost focus on doing God's work. Instead, they had become more focused in making this life more comfortable and more pleasurable for themselves. And these are the same struggles that we face at this time, where we may be devoted Christians, but yet, if we're not careful, our zeal may languish, and our fervor may decrease for God, and we may become entangled or entrapped in the affairs of this life, being more caught up in having a comfortable life here and enjoying all the pleasures that are available to us. So as we go through the narrative tonight, I hope that each one of us will reflect on our own lives and the choices we make and compare those to the sacrifices and the choices that the Nehemiah and the Jews made during this time. All right. And the first chart we're going to look at tonight is, again, our key dates and events. This is a chart we're familiar with, and the main thing I want to remind us of is just to refresh ourselves that we're in 445 B.C., This is the third return that Nehemiah is going to be leading, and this is the time when Jerusalem's walls will be rebuilt. Again, just want to flash before us this chart of the kings of the Medo-Persian Empire, and just remind you that we're in the period of King Artaxerxes Longimanus, who reigned from 465 to 425 BC, and Ezra, in Ezra 7 through 10, that's dated about 458 BC, and then Nehemiah in 445 B.C., and we presume this is also the same time when Malachi was written. And he is the last king of the Medo-Persian Empire that we're going to cover based on Bible history. And from this point going forward, we'll be looking at the years of silence. All right, so tonight's outline, we're going to be covering Nehemiah chapter 1 through 7. There's a lot of good points that we hope to look at, and I hope that each of the students will raise their hand and make comments and help bring an application, because I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to reflect on our lives as Christians in view of the work ethic and the zeal and the fervor of these people. All right, as we go through the first part of our narrative, I'd like for us to think about our questions. And the first question is, number one, what lessons can be learned from Nehemiah's response to the king's inquiry? All right, let's look at Nehemiah chapter 1. And first of all, I'd like to look at Nehemiah's character here. He says, "As I was in Shushan, the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem." First of all, I'd like for us to notice that Nehemiah is concerned for the Jews who have escaped. He's not waiting for people to come and tell him. And these people did not seek him out and give him these details. Instead, he's asking them. He's very interested. And when they tell him, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. Look at Nehemiah's response. "So it was, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." Now, was this a surface reaction? Did he act upset because he was supposed to act upset? No, you see, this is a very profound and deep movement that Nehemiah has. That he sits down, he's weeping, he's mourning, not just for a few minutes, but for many days. And this causes him to fast and to pray before the God of heaven. Now, let's look at his prayer that he offers to God. He says, I pray, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments, please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night for the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both my father's house and I have sinned. Again, please notice, this prayer is very similar to those that we've seen from Ezra and from Daniel, where Nehemiah identifies with the people, with his countrymen, and he confesses their sins, but he also confesses his own sins as well. I'm sure Nehemiah was a much more devout and a much better Jew than many of the Jews that we've read about whose sins are being confessed here. And even though Nehemiah might could have elevated himself compared to God and to the law that he had given them and the opportunities and the blessings that he had given them, whatever elevation Nehemiah might hope to express, it just pales in comparison to who God is and what he's given to them. And so naturally he includes his sin and makes no distinction between him and even the worst of the sinners of Israel. And he confesses his sins and those of his father's house alongside everyone else's. In fact, he says, we have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. Now, he's not asking the Lord to remember what he's forgotten. Instead, he's wanting him to think about the promise that God made. In fact, that's what he says next. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out to the farthest part of heaven, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. It's that promise that Nehemiah is asking God to think about, but not just think about it, but to actually act upon. He's asking for that mercy, for that deliverance that's promised back in the law of Moses. So he says, now these are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name. And let your servant prosper this day, I pray. So again, he's asking for God's mercy and fulfillment of this promise that Nehemiah and his servants might be blessed to do the work that God promised he would enable them to do. And he specifically ends the prayer by mentioning a potential means of opportunity, a potential way that God may do this. And he says, I pray and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. And he then explains, for I was the king's cupbearer. So Nehemiah was a servant to the king, who I'm sure was gained incredible experience, but yet he was a servant before the king. This provided an opportunity by which Nehemiah may be able to do some good. Now, in the next part of the narrative, let's look in Nehemiah chapter 2 at what transpires next. I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now, I had never been sad in his presence before. Therefore, the king said to me, why is your face sad since you are not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of the heart. So I became dreadfully afraid. Now, think for a second. Why would Nehemiah be dreadfully afraid? Different people in the class at this time may mention the fact that this would be very deadly, potentially, for Nehemiah, that it would be against the king's customs, it would be against the king's glory of his court to have sorrowful people in there. Everybody around the king should be happy, should be joyful, respectful, but they should not be sorrowful. And this is a king that had the power to remove people and to have them killed if they just came into his presence without asking. So if they came into his presence, well, that's yet another reason why he could have them destroyed. So naturally, Nehemiah was very afraid, and he should have been. And before we see what happens next, again, I'd like for us to think about Nehemiah and look at his character. Again, he's very sad based on the news that he's heard. Again, think, is this a surface-level reaction? No, he's deeply sorrowful. He's deeply troubled because he cares for his people. He cares about God, and he cares about his promises, and he cares about the work that God has set out for them. So, even though he cares for all this, and even though he's very scared, let's look at how he reacts to the king's question. May the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste and its gates are burned with fire? Is that not amazing? Here, Nehemiah, if he had any sense, he would say, oh, I'm sorry, my king, please forgive me, a momentary lapse. But instead, he uses the opportunity, instead to apologize, he uses an opportunity to explain the cause of his sorrow. He's transparent. He's honest. He tells exactly what the problem is without fear of any consequence. Then the king said to me, what do you request? Now, notice what Nehemiah does. So I prayed to the God of heaven. Somebody mentioned in class that this is the shortest prayer recorded in history. And you'll see that a lot in Nehemiah, that even in both his actions as well as just as he's recording the scripture, that he just interjects a prayer. It's like as he's writing or as he's thinking, he just pauses and he prays to God. And I think that's very good for us to think about. First of all, to notice that this is praying without ceasing. This shows us that we can have a prayerful mind, and that whenever we have any kind of opportunity or a need, even though it may be just for a split second, we can kneel before God's throne and ask for his grace and for his help in a time of need. And as we go through looking in scripture and seeing Nehemiah writing down the words of by inspiration of this history and then interjecting his prayer, then if it was good for him to do that, then will it not also be good for us as we read those same words to pause and make our requests known to God, to help us to be like the characters and the good character that we see displayed in Scripture? So we see Nehemiah turning to God in this very brief moment, but intense need. So he prays and he says to the king, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Then the king said to me, the queen also sitting beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river. And the king granted them according to the good hand of my God upon me. So we see in this part of the narrative three different parties responding. First of all, we see Nehemiah responding to the king's inquiry in both honesty, transparency, and with boldness, taking advantage of the opportunity that had been given to him to advance the Lord's cause. And we see the king responding favorably to that. And again, as we may mention before, there's no way this could have happened if Nehemiah had not already come into favor in the king's eyes. They would have had some kind of relationship with him being the cupbearer, so there would have been some level of trust and responsibility. But yet the king appreciated Nehemiah and gave him this incredible blessing and this incredible favor, with which would have been at great expense of his own personal expense, the expense of the kingdom, and allows Nehemiah to be granted leave to go do this work. But we also see God responding to Nehemiah's prayer. In verse 8, look who Nehemiah gives the responsibility or the blessing or the credit to. And the king granted them to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. So Nehemiah recognizes that it was God working in these events that was providentially answering his prayer and bringing about the opportunity to do this work that Nehemiah had in his heart to do. All right, getting back to our questions. In the next section of the narrative, I'd like for you to look at the people that Nehemiah approaches with this dream to rebuild the walls, and think about their reaction and also look at the enemies. And then in question 3, we want to look at some of the difficulties that the families had to overcome in rebuilding the wall and see if we can make some lessons and application for ourselves. So as Nehemiah heads back, Let's first look at the reaction of the enemies and introduce them. Then I went to the governors in the region beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. So this is different in the case of Ezra, where Ezra deliberately avoided or denied having any soldiers or an army go with him, and instead they sat and fasted, trusting in God to take care of them. Here we see that Nehemiah was accepting and willing for these captains, this army, to go, assuming he had a choice. But the main point is to notice the enemies that are introduced at this point. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard of it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. In a few minutes, we'll see that these people, Sanballat especially, seems to possibly have been a governor maybe of Samaria and to have been in charge in some army and had some official position. So given that we have Sanballat, possibly the leader, the governor of Samaria, and then we have Tobiah and Ammonite, why do we think these people would have been disturbed? Well, there's a couple different reasons we can think about. First of all, Sanballat may see another governor coming in of a weak city at this point, a city that he would have had some kind of control over, having an army in Samaria. He may see it as a rival, maybe, to his power. And then Tobiah, being an Ammonite, the Ammonites had come in and had a much greater influence after Jerusalem had been destroyed and the Jews had been removed. And contrast that with the lower position that they had while the Jews were in power. I mean, the Jews always dominated, generally, the Ammonites. And so both of these people would have been representing groups that would stand to lose power and favor and position if the Jews were to grow in position and favor. And so out of simply selfish motives, we can understand why they would have been deeply disturbed that somebody had come seeking the well-being of the children of Israel, because in fact the Israelites were their enemies. All right. So the next thing that Nehemiah does, or the first thing that he does once he gets to Jerusalem, is he's there for 3 days, we're told, and then he gives this account. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem which were broken down, and its gates which were burned with fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate, and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley, and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered the valley gate, and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone, or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. Now, I think there's something subtle here, but a very good point for us to consider. Nehemiah was very concerned about the people. We saw his distress, we saw his concern, and we saw his prayer. And when he was given an opportunity to do something, he immediately jumped at that opportunity when the king presented that for him. He took that leap by faith. But yet, when we see him here in Jerusalem, and he's ready to sit down and actually begin the work and present it to the people and do something, before he does anything, he walks around the walls. He surveys the walls, as we're told in Ephesians and Colossians, walking circumspectly. So he's taking the entire problem in. He's coming up with a plan, realizing what he has to deal with. So I think there's a tremendous amount of wisdom as a leader that Nehemiah is demonstrating here, that when there's, we see this kind of contrast, when there's a challenge, a work that he knows that he needs to do based on principle, given that it's a priority, then he accepts without thinking about it. Yet, however, when it comes to the details, the mechanics of how to do it, and how to work it out, he does his homework. He sits down, he thinks about it, he prepares so that he can give a response to the people, and he can lay out a plan. That's what people expect the leader to do, and that's naturally what he does do. So, and that brings up a good point. As we're looking at Nehemiah, we're going to have the opportunity to draw many lessons from Nehemiah. He is, in many ways, both he and Ezra, ideal leaders. And so they provide great examples, great role models as leaders. Now, in the class, we've only got one elder, but for the rest of us, we are still leaders also. We are parents, we are fathers, mothers, husbands, wives, teachers, neighbors, co-workers. Each one of us has an opportunity to be an influence on the people around us. And in so doing that, we also have the opportunity to be a leader, to make a difference, to do God's work. And so as we look at Nehemiah, I don't want us to think about, well, I hope the elders are paying attention to this, or I hope so-and-so is paying attention to this. I want each one of us to look at our own lives and look at the opportunities where we have to be leaders and make the application. Compare our heart and our character to that we see in Nehemiah and ask ourselves, do I have the same heart that Nehemiah does? And am I willing to lead like he does? So let's look at him and then compare ourselves to him and make the changes we need to make to be good leaders, just as Nehemiah and Ezra were. Alright, now let's look at the leaders when Nehemiah comes into them the next day. Then I said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also the king's words that he had spoken to me. Now before we look at their reaction, what could have his reaction been? Well, some people mention that it could have been a one of fear, that given how difficult it had been to build the temple and the desolation and the waste that they had still lived in, and given the strength of Tobiah and his army, that these people naturally could have been very afraid. And they might have said, no, this is not something we're equipped for. We can't handle it. We can't do it. They could have come up with many excuses. So fear could have been a motivating factor. Another motivating factor could have been one of pride. To a certain extent, Nehemiah accuses them a little bit. He says, you see the distress that we are in. And these leaders were there before Nehemiah arrived, and they had not done anything to build the wall. And it was something they saw and they knew, and they should have been doing something about it. So their pride and their ego could have reacted, and they could have said, well, who are you to come in and accuse us, and why don't you try living here for a while before you decide that you're going to accuse somebody and blame somebody? They could have reacted that way. Instead, how did they react? So they said, let us rise up and build. This is a tremendous reaction on their part. It shows humility, it shows faith, it shows desire and concern for the Lord's work. And even though they hadn't done anything up to this point, with Nehemiah's leadership and his example, and then Nehemiah, we see that he showed how God had helped them, and how he had been blessed by God, and how he had been blessed by the king. I think these things obviously would have been persuasive to them, given their desire. So they have a good case that's laid before them, and they have good hearts, and so they react favorably. So they set their hands to this good work. Now, how do the enemies react once they see the work begin to go to be undertaken? But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king? So first of all, I'd like for us to think about that. As leaders, as God's people, as Christians, we're going to have to endure people laughing at us. We're going to have to endure people despising what we're doing. They're not going to understand it. They're not going to think that it's something that's valuable. And when we make choices to do something that seems worthless and silly in their eyes, then naturally they're going to laugh at us and despise us. And that's a cost that we need to count ahead of time and prepare ourselves for. But also notice what they did. They didn't just laugh and they despised. They also threatened. When they said, will you rebel against the king? I mean, this this same tactic stopped the people from building the temple at the first. And they accused them of rebelling and treason in the letter that they sent to the king. And here they're insinuating and accusing as much in this case as well. But did it work this time? No. Look at the people's reaction. So I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. In tremendous faith. Therefore we his servants will arise and build. So the tremendous faith and a knowledge of the work that they need to do and their trust that God will help them do it. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. Again, notice the awareness of who he's dealing with. When he's dealing with Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, he recognizes these people are not Jews. They have no concern or love for the Jews. And so they are, in essence, enemies of God because they're trying to thwart God's work. They're trying to thwart God's people. And so a recognition that these people are to be separate and that they're not to have any part with them. Alright, so how does the work begin? Well, the construction is broken up into various assignments by family. Each family was given some work to do. They were assigned some section of the wall. Maybe it included a gate or a tower. And as we read through the chapter, we see how it's divided among the families. And we get some lessons, I believe, in looking at various kinds of work ethics, some of them good and some of them not so good. So here's a few interesting things I'd like for us to think about. Then Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brethren, the priests, and he built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and hung its doors. They built as far as the Tower of the Hundred and consecrated it, then as far as the Tower of Hananel. So first of all, notice here we have the high priest and his brethren, the priests, they're building this gate and hanging its towers, or hanging its doors and building as far as this tower and concentrating it, or consecrating it. These people could have said, hey, we're the priests. Hey, we're not wall builders. We're not masons. We don't do construction work. Our job is here at the temple. We're to stay focused. No, and they didn't say that. They were the first people that are mentioned here is rising up and doing the work. Unfortunately, not everybody demonstrated this kind of work ethic. Next to them, the Tekoites made repairs. That's very commendable, but notice what it says next. But their nobles did not put their shoulders to the work of the Lord. Contrary to the priest, here's some people who presumably felt they were too good for the work. Here's the nobles. They're not willing to put their shoulders to the work of the Lord. So notice this is something that would be strenuous physical effort, and this is something they were not willing to do, even though it was the work of the Lord. So that would have been incredible discouragement for the Tekoites, but yet they made their repairs. Notice next to him, Uzziel, the son of Harahiah, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs. Also next to him, Hananiah, one of the perfumers, made repairs, and they fortified Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Again, here's some people that could be saying, look, I'm a goldsmith, or I'm a perfumer. I don't know anything about building walls. I'm not a mason. I can't do construction. But yet, they didn't use that as an excuse. They took up their section, their piece of the wall, and they worked. They built up their piece. So I think that's a tremendous example for us. You think about Nehemiah. He was not a natural born leader in the sense that he wasn't born into that position. He wasn't in the lineage of David. He wasn't a priest. He was a servant. He was a cupbearer. Granted, it was before the king of Persia, and so he would have picked up a lot being in that court and having that experience. But yet he was a servant. And these people, they are also servants. Their focus, their concern is in doing the Lord's work. And whatever else their occupation may be, they lay that aside to do the Lord's work. That's their focus. And I think that's a tremendous lesson for us as well. We may not be the sons of preachers or the children of elders, but yet, if we are concerned about God's work, then we're going to take advantage of any opportunity we can, and we'll do what we can to create opportunities to do the Lord's work, whether it's in evangelism, or whether it's in service, or whether it's teaching, whatever the case may be, we'll do what we can to do God's work. So I think there's a commendable demonstration of a godly work ethic here. And next to them, Rephaiah, the son of Hur, leader of half the district of Jerusalem. Again, here's somebody, he's a leader, he's a noble, but yet he's making repairs. And next to him was Shallum, the son of Holohesh, leader of half the district of Jerusalem, another leader. But notice, he and his daughters made repairs. Apparently, he didn't have sons or they weren't able to come out and help them, but yet he didn't use any excuse. He and his daughters, the women of his family, were building this wall. Again, here's somebody who had an excuse, but yet he didn't use that. He didn't let that be an excuse and stop him from doing God's work. And then we see after him, Baruch, the son of Zebubbai, carefully repaired the other section. So somebody commended for being careful and being diligent in their work. And I look at the Tekoites again. After them, the Tekoites repaired another section. So one section of the wall was not good enough for these people. Even though they had been discouraged, they could have been discouraged by their nobles not helping. They repaired one section of the wall, and then they repaired another section. So again, tremendous work ethic that is demonstrated by these people. So what we want to think about as we look at chapter 4 is, first of all, why were the walls constructed so rapidly? And again, let's look at Nehemiah and how he compensated for some of the problems that the people faced while building the walls. So why did the people construct the wall so rapidly? One of the students mentions from Nehemiah chapter 4, we're told the people had a mind to work. And that is a key verse, if not the key verse of all the book of Nehemiah. That is one of, if not the primary lesson of the book, is this demonstration of a people who had a mind to work, and they were not going to let anything get in their way. There would be difficulties, there would be discouragements, there would be trials and obstacles, but yet somehow they were going to make a way. So let's look at how they demonstrated this in Nehemiah 4. But it so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria. Again, here's where we now know that Tobiah is not just some person, just this Horonite, we're told, from the city, that he has an army that he's in charge of, the army of Samaria. So apparently he's some leader there, possibly the governor of Samaria. And he said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day?" That's a good point, just to pause and think. There's a lot of tasks that we're called upon to undertake that are not going to be finished in a day. Maybe not in a month, maybe not in a year. It may be decades, maybe even a lifetime of work. It may be a work that somebody else has to pick up after us. But that doesn't mean that it's not important. And that doesn't mean that we can't do good in that work, that it's not needed or not necessary. So we can't let the length of the task discourage us. If it's a good work, if it's God's work, then we need to undertake it, no matter how long it'll take to do it. And even if it's not finished in a day, even if it's not finished in a lifetime, we still need to do it. Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned? Again, just the mocking. Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall." Again, notice the discouragement and the ridicule that God's people will have to face if they're doing God's work. And notice how Nehemiah, again, pauses in prayer. What does he do whenever he's in any situation that may be difficult or may be discouraging? He turns to God in prayer. "Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity." In other words, let them know what we have known. "Do not cover their iniquity, and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you. For they have provoked you to anger before the builders. So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height." And what was the reason? For the people had a mind to work. And that's just a tremendous lesson for us to think about today. Do we have to rebuild walls? No, not physical walls. But spiritual walls? Yeah. Is there work to do in God's kingdom? Is there work to do in the church? Have we done like Nehemiah? Have we stopped to survey the walls, to look at the condition of the kingdom, to look at the condition of the church? What does it need? What are its troubles? What things need to be done? What things need to be accomplished? What work needs to be done by us? Have we taken the time to look at that, to devise a plan and to prepare ourselves? Is that something that's in our heart to do? Are we distressed by this? Is this something that bothers us like it bothered Nehemiah? Have we prayed about it? Have we sought for God's help and His blessing? These are all excellent questions for us to think about, because there is a work to be done. The kingdom has been established, but it has been given to the saints to possess. And it's our responsibility to assume that possession, to take that same spirit and that same ambition that Alexander the Great demonstrated, that Nebuchadnezzar demonstrated, that Cyrus demonstrated, to grow the kingdom, to possess the kingdom. As God's people, that's what we're supposed to do. Of course, spiritually. But do we have that ambition for God and for His kingdom to see it grow and to see it thrive and prosper? Do we have that mind to work? Because that's what it's going to take to make it happen. Now, here's a few thoughts for us to think about as we try to make application on these points. In Proverbs 22:13, the lazy man says, "There is a lion outside. I shall be slain in the streets." There is always an excuse. If we don't want to work, we can come up with some kind of excuse. Now, if you look at Proverbs 26:16, it may be irrational. It may not be a good excuse. And if any sensible person from the outside is looking at it, they may be able to see right through it. But yet, we can come up with an excuse. But that's what lazy people do. That's not what we want to do. We want to have a mind to work. And so, if we do that, just like these people, there will be difficulties. But if we're of an upright heart and we're trying to do God's work, then it can be smoothed out. It can be made a highway, as we read in Proverbs 15:19. And in Ecclesiastes 11:4-6, we read, "He who observes the winds will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you do not know what is the way of the wind, or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child, so you do not know the works of God who makes everything. In the morning sow your seed, and in the evening do not withhold your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good." You see, there will always be a better day. There will always be a reason not to build today. Again, go back to Haggai. This is not the time to build. There's a better time coming. But we have to be careful that we're not putting off, we're not procrastinating, because well, today is not the perfect day. You know, there's some clouds that look like they're coming up, and it may rain, so I'm not going to sow the field today. We can't let those kinds of excuses. We have to take advantage of every day and every opportunity that's given us, because we don't know what will prosper. We don't know what good may come out of it. So let's not let these excuses prevent us from having the same spiritual work ethic that these people demonstrated spiritually in building these physical walls. All right, again, looking back at Nehemiah, is a good example of a leader. Now, it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry, and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. So, again, here's the people. Look at Nehemiah. There is a threat of physical violence of this army coming in to attack them, but yet they're trusting in God. They're looking to Him. Now, they're going to do something about it themselves. They're going to set up a watch. They're going to set up a guard. But yet, ultimately, their trust and their hope is in God to help see them through. Now, look how Nehemiah demonstrates a good character as a leader here. Then Judah said, "First of all, the strength of the laborers is failing, And then two, there is so much rubbish that we are not able to build a wall. So all these problems just start coming at Nehemiah. And our adversary said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So here's the threat of the violence. So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them, that's near these enemies, they told us 10 times. In other words, they just kept telling us and kept telling us, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. So here's this discouragement, these people who are being oppressed by these enemies, and yet they're constantly, and they're reminding Nehemiah. So Nehemiah's got these 4 different things that are coming at him. So what does he do? He focuses on the primary threat, the primary problem. He looks through and sees through all these distractions to the underlying problem, and then he addresses that. Therefore, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families, with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people. All right, and here's Nehemiah. He's setting them up, getting them ready to fight. He's getting them ready to do something that's very difficult. And whenever a leader asks somebody to do something very difficult, he needs to answer at least 2 questions. Why and how? And first of all, he tells them, here's the difficult thing. Do not be afraid of them. Now here's the how. Remember the Lord, great and awesome. So that is their source of strength. That is who they're going to rely upon to be their foundation and their rock. And now here's their motivation. Again, he could mention God, and that would be applicable there, but he says, fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your houses. All of these reasons Nehemiah gives to the people, and he reminds them of this and prepares them to fight. So, excellent demonstration of what a good leader would do. A very short speech, but yet it gets to the point that the people need to hear. Alright. So, progress continues, but it takes sacrifice. Obviously, it's going to be slowed down and hampered now with this threat. And it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. So, at first, everybody was concentrated and ready for the fight. And then once that threat kind of passed, not entirely, but at least it was abated a little bit, then work was able to resume, but not at the same pace that it was previously. So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction, while the other half held the spears. So things are becoming more difficult. So you have half that's working and the other half that's holding spears, shields, bows, and war armor. And the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Again, very good point. Look at the leaders. What kind of example were they being? They were right there with the people. They're behind them. They're supporting them. They're not elevated and isolated from the fray and from the worries and the concern. They're right there with the people. They're supporting them. They know what's going on. And the people see that. They would know that. And that would be so helpful to them. And that's a great thing for us to remember as leaders as well, that we can't ask people to do something that we're not willing to do and that we're not already doing and we're not there right beside them doing it and helping them with it. So those who built on the wall and those who carried the burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other hand they held a weapon. So the work continues, focus is a little bit divided, but yet it goes on. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. Then I said to the nobles, the rulers, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated far from one another on the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So here he's confronting with the problem that they're spread out all over this huge city. Remember, this city was built for probably hundreds of thousands of people, and now they only have tens of thousands of people there, not to mention all the rubble and whatnot. So they're spread out and they're using this trumpet system, if you will, to communicate where the need is. And wherever they hear the trumpet, they're supposed to rally there. But yet, where is the confidence? Where is the hope? Where is the trust? Our God will fight for us. So we labored in the work, and half of the men held the spears. This is the sacrifice they had to make from daybreak until the stars appeared. So this is not an 8-to-5 job. As soon as the sun comes up till after it goes down and the stars show up, the people are working. At the same time, I also said to the people, let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day. This is the same people, and they're being guards at night and working by day. I don't know when these people slept. I mean, obviously they had to sleep some, but it would have been very little. I mean, they're working double shifts trying to get this work done. So they're pulling out all the stops, making whatever sacrifices necessary to make sure this critical work gets done. Now, Nehemiah, just like the leaders, the elders of the city, is he isolated? Is he separated from the work? No, he's right there, and he's part of it. So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, in other words, my security guards, took off our clothes, except that everyone had to take them off for washing. So everybody that's Nehemiah has direct control or responsibility over, they're all focused on this work too, and they're all so busy, they don't even have time to take their clothes off for going to sleep at night or for doing anything. There's no time to relax. They're focused on this task from the time they get up to the time they lay down, and not very much of that in between. All right. So the work continues, but the problems continue also. So the next thing we want to look at in the narrative is Nehemiah chapter 5, where Nehemiah has to deal with the problem of usury. So you know, as we look at that, we want to think about what's wrong with the nobles expecting some form of interest or repayment of the debts that were owed them. And again, let's look at Nehemiah and think about his example as a leader and as a manager, and see what we can learn and what we can make application of. So the problem of usury in Nehemiah chapter 5. And there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren. So it was the Jews that was the source of this problem. No mistake about that. For there were those who said, we, our sons, and our daughters are many. Therefore, let us get grain that we may eat and live. What was the problem? The people didn't have any food. Why? Now they go on to explain. There were also some who said, we have mortgaged our lands and our vineyards and houses that we might buy grain because of the famine. Again, here is an incredible excuse. If somebody was not inclined to work, they could say, look, there's this famine. I mean, it's going to be all we can do to have food. We got to focus on making sure that we have food. So, you know, the problems just keep coming. And this is the first time that we actually learn of this famine that the people are undergoing. But that's not the point. The point is that these people, because of this, they had mortgaged their lands and their vineyards, so they had gone in debt just so they would have money to have food. And then there was other problems. There were also those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and our vineyards. More people have gone in debt, not because of the famine, but to pay taxes. Now, what was the problem out of all this? Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren. Our children are as their children. What does that mean? Well, what they're saying is look, we're no different than the people in captivity. We are back in captivity again. And that's what they explain in the next sentence. And indeed, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. So here we see the problem of the usury. These people are charging interest, and they're taking the collateral, the lands and the vineyards, away from the people. So the people are in great debt. They can't pay it off. The debt just keeps accumulating. And then they don't have the means to pay it off, because as farmers, they don't have any source of income without land and without vineyards. So naturally, we can understand Nehemiah's reaction. And I became very angry when I heard their outcry in these words. Now, he doesn't just react and just, you know, kind of fly off the handle, so to speak. He deals with the problem. He takes some time. Another good example and a good lesson for us to think about. After serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and rulers and said to them. So he recognizes the source of the problem, and he tells them, each of you is exacting usury from his brother. So I called a great assembly against them. Now the problem with usury is that it's something that was strictly prohibited in Exodus 22:25, Leviticus 25:35-41, and Deuteronomy 23:19-20. So the long and short of the problem, or the solution to the problem, the rectification of the problem, is that they were to stop the usury and they were to give the land back. And the people agreed to do that. But notice how Nehemiah speaks to them. And I said to them, according to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brethren who were sold to the nations. All right, so they've come out of captivity, and it apparently required some expense and some financial backing. And you think about these third waves, there would have been an investment for these people to come back. Now indeed, will you even sell your brethren? Or should they be sold to us? Then they were silenced and they found nothing to say. In the sermons, Brother Jeff has been talking to us about the qualifications of the elders, and one of those was convicting those who contradict sound doctrine by the context. And here we see, when you think of Jesus, first of all, we think of Jesus as being the ideal demonstration of that very point. You think about how he silenced the Pharisees and silenced the Sadducees with very simple questions that they couldn't answer without exposing their hypocrisy to the people. And in this case, we see Nehemiah doing the same thing. The people are silenced. They don't have an answer to Nehemiah's very simple question. Again, not because of their hypocrisy, but because of their guilt and because of their conscience. They cannot answer or excuse what they have done. So he goes on to tell them what they're doing is not good. And should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of our nation, of the nations, our enemies? And then he says, I also with my brethren and my servants am lending them money and grain. So he's helping these people who are in need, but he is not charging interest. He is not collecting the collateral. Instead, he says, please let us stop this usury. Restore now to them, even this day. So the people agree to restore it, but then Nehemiah wisely requires an oath from them, the priest, that they will do this. So the people are publicly bound and responsible to do something before the other people and before God that they were called in oath upon. So Nehemiah then binds the oath with this penalty. So may God shake out each man from his house and from his property who does not perform this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said, Amen, and praise the Lord. Then the people did according to this promise. And keep in mind, this is all happening while the wall is being built. These are all part of the problems that they're having to deal with. But yet, Nehemiah doesn't drive the people away. It's something he confronts, and they're very careful to do what the law requires of them. And they're very careful to be thoughtful of the people who are in need. And I think you see that especially in the next section. So in Nehemiah 5:14-19, we read, Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor, and this is kind of obviously retrospective as we look at this, in the land of Judah, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years. Not just a few days, not a few weeks, not a few months, not even just a couple of years, but for 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provisions. And what makes this so amazing is when you compare and contrast that to the former governors. So he goes on to explain, But the former governors, who were before me, laid burdens on the people, and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants bore rule over the people. So all of Nehemiah's predecessors, they were charging some kind of tax, and they were taking advantage of their rule. Was this unfair? I don't know. He doesn't seem to suggest so. Maybe a little bit in the sense that even their servants were the people. But yet Nehemiah didn't do that. And he explains why. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. Indeed, I also continued the work on this wall. So his focus was on God and for the people that were doing his work. And notice the other sacrifice that he made. I also continued the work on this wall, and we did not buy any land. All my servants were gathered there for the work. So Nehemiah could have used his governorship as an opportunity to develop his own wealth, his own portfolio, if you will. He could have made investments and could have built up the land and could have been growing his wealth. But instead, all of his assets, all of his people, all of his wherewithal was focused on building this wall. And that's what he says. All my servants were gathered there for the work. And at my table were 150 Jews and rulers, besides those who came to us from the nations around us. Now that which was prepared daily was one ox and six choice sheep. Also fowl were prepared for me, and once every 10 days an abundance of all kinds of wine. Yet in spite of this, I did not demand the governor's provisions, because the bondage was heavy on this people. So again, we've been talking about, and I can't help but think we've been talking about the qualifications of elders. And one of the qualifications is to be hospitable. This is an extreme example, but this is hospitality. This is concern for people in need, bringing them in, taking care of them, doing what they need to make sure that they're okay. This is a great example of caring for the people and providing for their needs and for their benefits. And how does he do this? Is he doing it with his income and what he gets as being a governor? No, he's doing this out of his personal wealth, his personal account. He's not doing this out of his governor's provisions. And he does this because he recognizes the work is so heavy and so difficult on the people. And so he's making whatever sacrifice he can to make it as easy as possible on the people. I can't help but think that we don't understand what true leadership is. When we talk about we need more leaders, we need to groom people to be leaders, we need to develop leadership, I think there's a misunderstanding there. In the scripture, we don't see people who are groomed for leaders. If anybody ever was, it was Moses. But yet, he wasn't ready to be a leader until he had been humbled by God and spent 40 years in the desert in Midian. And leaders come from servants, those who have the true servant heart, the servant attitude. In fact, that's what we see in Scripture. Before I flip to the next slide, I want to pause and note, again, look at Nehemiah interjecting this prayer right in the middle of the recording of history here. Remember me, my God, for good, according to all that I've done for this people. A great example of prayer, as well as noting where his concern is. His concern is for the people. And he's trusting God to make good in his investment. He knows to whom he's committed his soul. So again, going back to our topic of leaders and where they come from. Leaders are first and foremost servants. Leaders come from servants. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them." That's what all of Nehemiah's predecessors done. But look, here's the instruction from the Lord. "Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave." Now, that seems pretty extreme, but this, again, a true leader does not ask his people to do anything that he is not willing and not already doing himself. So, we see from the Lord himself, "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." If we think about the sacrifices that our Lord had to make, what he gave up, and the suffering that he went through for our sake, then we cannot help but be humbled and give up any justification for us to make any excuse and complain of the small and paltry sacrifices that we have to make to serve him and to serve his people. Notice again the Lord's example in John 13. "Do you know what I have done to you?" He said this right after washing their feet. "You call me teacher and Lord, and you say well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet, for I have given you an example, that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them." This is our example. This is what our servant master, this is the example that he left for us. And this is what he calls us to do. And this is the same attitude and the same mentality that Nehemiah demonstrated for us as we go through this narrative. All right. So we ask the question, what are some of the traits, some of the characters or virtues that you see in Nehemiah that exemplify a good or ideal manager or a leader in God's kingdom? And some people talked about his great concern and his great sympathy for the people, how much he cared for them. He demonstrated that, of course, when, first of all, just when he was wanting to know what their condition was, and then his mourning and fasting and praying and setting his heart to seek their welfare. And then we see that also in his sacrifice and just taking care of their needs and making sure they had food, and lending out of his own wealth without charging interest, and then just providing food directly to people who needed it. Other people talked about his management ability in the sense that he was able to cut through all the different distractions, thinking about when the threat of physical violence was upon them. He was able to cut through the different problems and focus on what was the immediate need, which was dealing with that threat. And he was able to compensate for that. So, judgment and wisdom there, discretion. And some people talked about in the class about how he listened to the people when they brought problems and complaints to him. He just didn't dismiss them rapidly and say, well, that's your problem, or there's just, I'm focused on this big work and there's just a few of you and you're just being a distraction. And that's something I think we can all sympathize with. Myself having little children, sometimes I'll be busy with something and the kids will bring me a problem that, some kind of argument or some kind of problem. And there's a temptation there to say, look, you two just go deal with it yourselves. I've got to stay focused here on what I'm doing. But Nehemiah, he didn't just turn these people away. He was patient and he dealt with each of the problems because he realized if the problems were coming to him, then they were real problems and they needed to be dealt with and they weren't going to go away and they weren't to get any better. So he didn't dismiss the people rapidly, but he cared about them. He was concerned about them. He listened to them. Those were some of the different lessons we talked about. And another person again mentioned the servant attitude that Nehemiah had. So there was lots of good points that were made. And at this point, we looked at our key lessons. And we talked about previously, one of the main points being the work ethic of the people. And the other main point being the example of true leadership that Nehemiah demonstrated. So we had several little aspects or virtues that we had brought out as of demonstration of this leadership character. The awareness, the concern, the sympathy, and love for God's people that several people mentioned. We talked about his praying without ceasing, that example that he demonstrated that was just very quick to turn to God in prayer, just the slightest need, even if it was for just the briefest moment. We talked about Nehemiah surveying the walls, walking circumspectly, as we're commanded to do in Ephesians 5:15, that he was aware of the need, he was aware of the problem, he was concerned about it, and he did his homework, he prepared, he went and looked at the problem before he actually undertook the actual effort. We talked about not Nehemiah, but the Jewish leaders whose position and pride were sacrificed for others' good. They gave those things up without hesitation because they were concerned about God and about his people. And we talked about the need to that we'll have to endure ridicule, scorn, intimidation, maybe even threats to do God's work. And so we'll have to deal with discouragement from without, but we may also have to deal with discouragement from within. Remember the Tekoites, the nobles who did not put their shoulders to the Lord's work. Yet the Tekoites built their section of the wall, and they built a second one. So we can overcome, and we'll have to overcome such discouragement. And then think about the potential, the power of this united, consuming effort. That these people, they bound themselves together and were determined to do this work, and they did it very rapidly. We'll read in just a second. They built the wall in 52 days. It's just an amazing feat. This amazing feat makes you wonder if not a similar feat could be accomplished today. Again, not thinking physically, but spiritually, if we were focused on God's work. There's a great potential and great power here in a united and devoted, consuming effort. Even God noticed in Genesis 11:6, when Noah's descendants were building the Tower of Babel, he said, "Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them." Of course, the Lord interrupted their efforts and prevented it from happening because he took away their unity of language. And so God was not with them. But it makes you wonder, what could we do today if we were united upon God's work? And if we were speaking the same thing, if we did have the same mind, and if we were focused on God's work, what could be done? God said of the people back then, nothing will be withheld from them. And so we see the same thing happening here with the Israelites who are focused on doing God's work, on building the walls. Another point is a leader has to be able to focus on the primary threat, the most critical and immediate need, has to be able to avoid being distracted. We need to remember our motivation and our source of strength. We need to be able to answer the how and the why, to be able to persuade people. We need to be willing to burn the midnight oil. And think about Jesus in Mark 16:30-34, and Paul laboring night and day. These people, they demonstrated that true leaders are going to have to make extra sacrifice, and that sacrifice will often come in the form of losing sleep, of being busy late at night while other people are resting. And also, we need to, good leaders have to keep God's law carefully. And you think about or remember Nehemiah in this point of usury that he made sure the people followed the law. I mean, there was the abuse of the people, but there was also the fact that this was not according to God's law. And we'll see that same carefulness demonstrated as we go later in the book, as we talk about the genealogy. And then we also need to notice how Nehemiah did not take advantage of his brethren, even though he may even had opportunity and even a right or an obligation. This is something he didn't do so he could be a servant to the people and so that he could help them in their difficult need and as they were doing a difficult work. Notice how Nehemiah helped us, or he silenced those who contradicted or convicted those who contradict by using questions according to the standard. A good leader will have to lead through service and sacrifice. Again, remember, the last shall be first. And in a second, we're going to talk about not fraternizing with the enemy. A good leader cannot be afraid to rock the boat. And also, as we'll see later, a good leader will have to be proactive and not reactive. In other words, he can't be just putting out fires. He's got to be looking ahead, looking at the problems that are going to come, the difficulties that are going to come, and he has to prepare for those. He can't just be a firefighter. All right, so as we go into the remainder of the narrative, we're going to pause to look at some enemies that were trying to entrap him, namely Tobiah, and we're going to look at Nehemiah's wonderful relationship building skills and contrast that with those of some of the other Jews. So, Sanballat, and again, keep in mind, this is all going on while the walls are being built. Sanballat four different times sent a letter to Nehemiah and said, "You know, we need to talk this over. Why don't you come out here and meet me in the plain?" And of course, Sanballat's intention was to harm Nehemiah. He was going to take him out of the way. and remove him again physically, violently. But Nehemiah, what was Nehemiah's answer? I can't. I'm busy. I've got a great work that I have to do, and I don't have time for this. Again, Nehemiah, I'm sure he may or may not have been aware of the threat, but regardless, he was focused on the work that had to be done, and he had no time to waste trying to establish some kind of compromise or build some bridge to a party that was effectively the enemy, who really had no interest in the walls being built. There was nothing they could do to help. They were going to only slow things down and compromise him. And so he turned those down. And eventually, Sanballat sent an open letter. And it was even accusing Nehemiah of treason and rebellion, saying, well, you want to be the king, and this is why you're doing this, and you need to come talk this over with me before I go and tell the king about this. So again, he's turning up the heat, making it more threatening, but yet Nehemiah knows there is no validity to that, and he is not afraid of that, and that he still has his trust in God, and he's focused on doing his work. So the next thing they try to do is someone comes to Nehemiah and tells him to flee into the safety because the people are coming into the city to kill him. And Nehemiah sees that this is, again, something that he should not do as the leader, that he should not demonstrate this kind of fear or running. Instead, he must stand his ground. And then after thinking that, he realizes that, again, this is another trap, that they're trying to defame his character so they can have some basis to accuse him of sin, because he shouldn't be going into the temple. He did not have the bloodline to do that. And so, again, this is another trap that's set before him, but because of his focus on the work and his focus on being an example for the people, it's not something that even slows him down. So in all of this, the wall is finally finished in an amazing 52 days. That's less than 2 months. This is a phenomenal amount of work. And the only way it can be explained is what we said earlier. The people had a mind to work. And because God was with them. His hand was upon them for good and to bless them and take care of them. And so this is a tremendous inspiration for us to think about what we can also do if we focus our lives in doing the Lord's work, and if we have that same kind of mind to work. Now, one of the other discouragements that Nehemiah was having to deal with and having to face was the fact that there was many in Judah that were pledged to Tobiah. Even though Nehemiah had clearly separated himself from Tobiah and from these people, and he clearly drew the lines and said, you have no part with us, and you have no part in the memorial of Israel. There were other people who were had not done such a good job of separating themselves. In fact, there were some people that had married some of Tobiah's children, and his sons and his daughters had married different people among the Jews. In fact, even some of the priests. And so there was letters being sent back and forth between Tobiah and the other Jews, and there was this intermarriage. And then these people were constantly coming before Nehemiah and trying to talk Tobiah up, tell good things about Tobiah and all the things good things he had been doing. And then they were turning around and acting as spies and reporting whatever Nehemiah said back to Tobiah. And so there were a lot of people who had fraternized with the enemy, so to speak, that they had compromised themselves and had not separated themselves and made a very clear and very distinct stand. And in fact, that was actually another one of the points that was made by the class, is the boldness of Nehemiah, and that he was kind, but he was very direct, he was very straightforward about who he was and about what he needed to do and what other people needed to do. And his boldness is incredible, and it's necessary for a leader to have that. And it's something that each one of us need to think about. And one of the other things is that we talked about is contrasting Nehemiah with Ezra. In the last class, we looked at Ezra and how he dealt with the problem of people intermarrying And when he found out, he was distraught. He pulled his beard, you know, rent his clothes. But what does Nehemiah do? He goes, and he doesn't pull his beard out. He pulls the beard out of the people who had done the intermarrying. He's extremely bold. When he's dealing with a situation where the people should have known better, he very clearly and decisively moved in and spoke to them, confronted them, and rebuked them. Again, a great example in boldness, again, with judgment and with discretion, which we'll look at in the next class. But Nehemiah was very bold, and I think that's a very important application for us as well today, because we have a very unique and similar situation in the sense that in Athens we have so many Christians and we have so many congregations who have been here for multiple generations. And over time, lots of people have married between different families and whatnot. And so everybody's very connected on a family level. And that can be a source of discouragement or hindrance whenever if we know somebody's not doing what's right, or we know that something needs to be confronted or needs to be dealt with. We may be like these other Jews who were bound to Tobiah in marriage. We may be less inclined to say something about that because we don't want to hurt our relationship with our in-laws or whatever the family is. But is that what Nehemiah did? Was he that way? No. He very distinctly drew the lines, and he didn't care what the family relationship was. He was going to do what was right, no matter what the cost, and he was going to make whatever sacrifice was necessary. Nehemiah was not afraid to rock the boat. If we're not careful, we can fall into a trap of making decisions or not making decisions because we're afraid of rocking the boat, because we're afraid of upsetting what appears to be peace and stability. But it's not peace if God's not happy. I can't help but think of Jesus when he said that he came to bring a sword and not peace, that he would set son against father and mother against daughter. And that is the nature of the Lord's kingdom. It is not something that follows family lines. And those that try to follow family lines will not be able to have a part in the kingdom. That is something that will sooner or later will eventually have to be dealt with. So a good example in Nehemiah of doing that, of being ready to make that sacrifice. So he did not entangle himself in bridge building because he was focused on the Lord's work. Now finally, as we close, let's look at a few more advancements that Nehemiah made and consider our questions 10 and 11. What was the primary function of these governors, and what purpose might Nehemiah's recording of the genealogy have served? So, as we mentioned already, the city was huge, but it was underpopulated. There was not enough people there. So Nehemiah set up governors to watch or guard over the city, especially around a person's house. So people would be aware of their neighborhood, kind of like almost a neighborhood watch, if you will. So Nehemiah did this to help maintain the order of the city. So again, being proactive, looking ahead. But he was also, even though he was focused on this monumental work, he was also concerned about the smaller details. He was also concerned about things such as the genealogy. So Nehemiah called all the people together and registered a genealogy of the people that were with him, but he also even included the genealogy of the first return, the one that's recorded in Ezra. And there's an emphasis that's placed on the careful keeping of the law. This point's made in Ezra, but Nehemiah incorporates it as well, that some of the Levites back in the first return with Zerubbabel were not permitted to participate in the Levitical priesthood functions because they could not establish by their bloodline, by their ancestry, that they had the right to serve as Levitical priests. So there was this emphasis on keeping the law carefully, even if they were in the middle of doing a supposedly great work for the Lord. So again, very good demonstration of keeping the weightier matters as well as the smaller matters of the law. And something for us to think about as well as God's people. All right, that's all we had scheduled to cover for tonight. I appreciate everybody's time and attention, and appreciate you staying with me as we ran a little bit longer tonight. I guess that's one luxury of being able to record the class outside the confines of the 40-minute window.